today I'm going to be dealing with some very difficult issues in philosophy, in metaphysics and philosophy of mind. And you may feel at the end of the lecture that that I haven't said anything clear enough to warrant proceeding. But next week, on Thursday, I shall talk in a more concrete way about the human face with pictures. And this might make up for the abstraction of what I'm going to say today. I hope so, anyway. So the question is, where am I? And I'm continuing the argument of last week, last Thursday, in which I discussed the view from nowhere, the view from somewhere, rather, the view which you and I have, and which is connected, or seems to be connected, with our ability to identify ourselves in the first person case, and to address others as you, rather than just he. Now, the God whose doings are recounted in the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, does not, at first sight, look very much like the God of the philosophers whom I discussed in the first lecture. Yet, in his own way, he is hidden. And despite his busy and all-encompassing interest in worldly affairs, he acts at a distance from his devotees. In Exodus chapter 33, verse 20, God says to Moses, "Thou canst not see my face, for there shall no man see me and live." Although Moses is permitted a rear view of the Lord as he passes by. The imagery throughout the book of Exodus is strange and disturbing. God stands proxy for all that we do not know and cannot control, for all the areas of life in which we might unknowingly step on ground that gives way beneath us to our ruin. He is nowhere and everywhere, lying in wait for us and also fleeing as soon as he is sensed. Yet there is one thing that God says about himself which is of universal significance, and this he says on his first encounter with Moses, speaking from the burning bush. Moses seeks to know the name of God in order that he can testify to the authenticity of his vision. But God refuses to name himself, saying instead, "I am that I am," adding that if the Israelites ask for some guarantee of his mission, Moses is to say that he has been sent by I am. Everything else about God is accidental. This alone is essential, that he refers to himself in the first person. In other words, he, like us, is a person who can utter the word I and relate to his worshippers, I to you. He is to be addressed as another subject. Hence he reaches out to his people, not through coercion and force, but through a covenant. Talmudic authorities regard the Torah as a record of revelations granted to Moses and first set down by him. Modern biblical scholarship regards the Torah rather as a compilation put together during the Babylonian exile from four or more earlier sources. However you look at it, this document contains, in narrative and imagistic form, profound truths about God's relation to the world, expressed in a way that immediately engages the emotions of the reader. God is a person, an agent, and an I, and he relates to his people through promises, obligations, laws, and covenants, all of which presuppose that both he and they are free agents, able to change the flow of events and at the same time to take responsibility for doing so. In this lecture, I want to say something about what that involves. In particular, I want to raise the question, what and where am I in the world of objects? That question, I maintain, is a necessary preliminary to the question of God's presence, the question, what and where is God? The question of God's presence often looks insuperable. Rightly understood, however, it resembles the question of your and my presence, and we must try to answer them both together. The Torah constantly returns to the paradox of the transcendental God who is immanent in the world of his creation. God is shown as moving among the Israelites. He is a real presence in their midst, and his covenant requires not merely that they obey his laws, but that they erect a house for him, a place in which he can be encountered, even if never face to face. But God's emphasis on ritual, cleanliness, and the punctilious arrangements for housing him, which are supposedly the conditions of his presence, also emphasize his absence. The temple is God's point of entry into this world, the point of intersection of the timeless with time, to borrow Eliot's beautiful words. It is the place of a God who acts in this world while being impassably removed from it. The ritual is designed to show this, to keep the people at a distance from the Holy of Holies, shut off from God by everything except their obedience. It is as though the paradox of the transcendent God who is immanent in the world of his creation, of the eternal and immutable who moves and changes in time, of the remote sustainer who is an object and subject of love, that this paradox is resolved in the rituals of the temple. Do we just say that these are things we cannot understand, and that the ritual is there to rescue the incomprehensible by representing it as a mystery? That is often said of the Christian Eucharist, but it makes the dividing line between faith and scepticism too fine. Let us look again at God's response to the question posed by Moses. Moses asked for God's name, in other words, for an identification, something that would enable Moses to know who it is that he is talking to. And God responds by identifying himself in the first person. He is saying to Moses that he, God, is a self-conscious subject. Like Moses, God has a subjective point of view. He does not exist only outside the world, with a view from nowhere that he can never share. He moves in the world, in a somewhere of his own. This is a radical thing for the Khawazar Sui to claim. It is precisely what sends shivers down the Islamic spine. How can God be greater than everything, a transcendental unity without parts or partners, if he is also in the world, addressing his creatures in the first-person case? Sure, he occasionally lapses into the first person in the Quran, but only in ways that make it clear that it is really the other and not the self that is speaking. He speaks through the angel Gabriel and through the recitations of the prophet, and that is what the word Quran actually means. But he is not an I among others in a world that he shares. The unity of God in Islamic thought is not simply a matter of God's being the unique instance of something. It is a metaphysical condition that nothing else can manifest. Spinoza took this thought seriously, arguing that there is at least one Khawazar Sui, and also at most one. Hence, everything that exists is a mode of the one substance, and there is no distinction between God and the world. I find it hard to believe that the Islamic doctrine of Tawhid can avoid moving in the same direction. I've forgotten again to put all my little things. We've got up to the last of those. Great. Tawhid comes from the word wahid, which means one. If we do go in this direction, however, God's presence becomes an ubiquitous presence in which we are all absorbed, and none of us relates to God as Moses thought he did, I to you and you to me. So clearly we need to get a little clearer about the meaning of the word I. Philosophers have frequently argued that I does not function as a name and does not provide an identifying description of the speaker. Moreover, when I refer to myself in the first person, I do not apply some criterion of identity, some method or procedure that enables me to say, this thing to which I am referring is I. If I used such a procedure, then I could misapply it. I could make mistakes, coming to the conclusion that this thing that I am referring to is not I, but someone or something else. And that supposition is absurd. This does not mean that the word I is empty. I is what philosophers call an indexical term, like here and now. But it is also, although some philosophers have doubted this, a referring expression, correctly used only of a certain kind of thing, namely of a self-conscious and self-referring subject. Moreover, the word I can be meaningfully replaced in all its occurrences by other pronouns or by a proper name. And I am Roger Scruton is a statement of identity, and one about which I could be wrong, even though I make it with special authority, having had a lifelong acquaintance with Roger Scruton. When speaking in the first person, I can refer authoritatively to an object in the external world as well. I know, for example, that I am standing up and facing a room of people. And from this I infer that a particular body, namely my body, is disposed in a particular way. When I move my arm like this, I know immediately and on no basis that my arm has moved. And any error in this matter must be explained in some special way. I may see an arm in a mirror and wonder whether it is mine. But in all normal perceptions, I have an immediate awareness of my body and can identify it without criteria as mine. Likewise, when I attribute mental states to myself, which is B of the fourth of those, there is, over a large range of cases, both immediate awareness and also a kind of immunity to error. I know that I have a pain in my finger, that I am thinking of Sam, and that I am hungry. And I know on no basis and without deploying a criterion of identity that this pain, this thought, and this hunger belong to one thing, which is I. Of course, I could be wrong in thinking that this I is Roger Scruton. I might in fact be Gordon Brown suffering from delusions of grandeur. But I cannot be wrong in thinking that this unity that I identify is I. As I suggested last time, that is what Kant meant by the transcendental unity of apperception. A self-conscious being apprehends the unity of the I, and this unity is transcendental in that it is not something that he arrives at by way of a conclusion, but something presupposed in all his knowledge, including the knowledge that he has of himself and including any argument that he might be able to present to refute this claim. So here is what God is saying to Moses. I am one thing with the kind of unity that you discover in yourself when you are alert and addressing another. This transcendental unity does not tell me to what kind I belong or what role I have in the world of objects. It identifies me, rather, as a unique point of view upon the world of objects. And in that respect, God is saying, he is like us. He has that transcendental and original uniqueness which is implied by his mastery of the first-person case. More, he can know himself as one without implying that there are others like him in any other respect. Maybe there is more to his unity than this. Maybe he is simple and substantial, as the medieval philosophers thought. Maybe he has that ineffable tawhid that the Muslims so fervently believe in. But what is interesting to me is that he is claiming to be present in our world in something like the way that we are present, through a view from somewhere that grants him a place as a subject in the world of things. Now, I can know myself as I only if I can spontaneously refer to myself, identify my mental states, situate myself in relation to others. All of those capacities involve mental acts. I am I to myself only to the extent that I am you to others. And this means that I must be capable of that free dialogue in which I take charge of my presence before the presence of you. The same has to be true of God if Moses is to encounter him. You may wonder how God can be free to act in a world in which everything is governed by scientific laws. You may think that the relation of dependence which binds the world as a whole to the necessary being, the relation which I discuss in the first lecture, leaves science in charge when it comes to saying what causes what. And science cannot, in the nature of things, trace an empirical event to a transcendental cause. But there is a way out of that objection, or at least a way of postponing the answer to it. As I argued last time, the human being is situated in the world of objects and is himself an object in that world. All attempts to pinpoint his freedom and agency in the world of objects will lead to the kind of nonsense that we find in Libet's account of the neuroscience of decision. Look for God's will in the physical world and you will certainly find it, just as you will find my will in the world in which I move. But look for the gap in the physical order, the inexplicable departure from the laws of nature, which is the physical reality, so-called, of God's will, and you will find nothing. Freedom, action, and accountability are properties of the person. And it is only when we see God as a person that we will understand that this is true also of him. He is present in our world in the same sense that we are, as a subject. And when we attribute an event to his will, we are saying that there is a reason for it, and that this reason is God's answer to our own question, why? We are not describing it as a miraculous intervention, and we can accept Hume's skepticism about miracles while acknowledging God's presence as an agent in our world. This does not mean that there is no puzzle about God's agency. Of course there is. But it is a special case of the puzzle about agency as such. What is it to act in the world, and how is the capacity for action connected with the first-person perspective? Clearly, it would be a mistake to approach this question by starting from the problem of God's agency, which is a limiting case. We need to begin from our own position and ask how it is that we act in the world and what makes action possible. The first thing to note is that persons are not only subjects, they are objects among others in a world that they share. They are living, breathing, acting beings, embodied and occupying physical space. Moreover, they are not two things, a human body and a soul inside. To think in that Cartesian way is to reify the subject. In other words, to commit the error that Kant identified in the Paralogisms chapter of the first critique, the Critique of Pure Reason. This is the error of supposing that the subject can be understood as objects are understood, through categories of substance and cause. The subject is the view from somewhere, but does not appear within that view. For if it did so, I might misidentify it, or even conclude that there is no such thing. It is just as possible to develop a science of the human being as it is to develop a science of any other animal. The theory of evolution and the science of the brain promise to show what makes this peculiar organism tick, and maybe it will turn out to be not so very different from what makes other organisms tick, in particular those organisms that are close to us on the evolutionary tree. If we deny that, then we deny the best explanations so far given of man's place in nature. Creationists think they have a better explanation, but that is because they fail to see that they have no explanation at all, but merely a formula for transferring the unexplained to the realm of the inexplicable. At the same time, we are presented with a problem when it comes to accounting for our ways of understanding and relating to each other. For we don't relate to each other as animals, not even when doing the things, fighting, grooming, copulating, that dominate the social lives of animals. We see each other as the originators of our acts. The person comes before us as the thing that enters the world through his actions. Although the causal chains that bind past to future run through us as they run through everything, we do not refer our thoughts, actions, and emotions to their endless prelude in the world of objects, but rather to the subject who accounts for them and within whose first-person perspective they lie. Hence there exists in all natural languages the idiom of agent causality, as it has been called. We refer to actions as events, but we identify their causes not as events, but as agents. It is not the movement of John's arm that caused Mary to fall, but John, who pushed her. John is the cause of all those things that issue from his acting presence in the world. Moreover, while we all belong to a natural kind, because we are all members of the species Homo sapiens sapiens, it is not as members of that kind that we identify ourselves when we refer to ourselves in the first person. We identify ourselves as persons and assume that we endure as persons. As a human being, I have a past and a future. As a person, I lay claim to that past and that future as mine, as things that originate in me, in this very subject who must account for them to you. Persons do not form a natural kind, and the concept of personal identity is problematic in a way that the concept of animal identity is not. This we have learned from Sidney Shoemaker and others, and among the many results of modern analytical philosophy. Now, other animals are conscious, which is to say that they respond to their environment, by responding to how it seems. Animals, you might say, are repositories of seemings, and this lifts them to a certain extent from the world of objects and sets them nearer to ourselves. We can relate to them not by pushing them around, as we relate to ordinary physical things, but by changing the way things seem to them. We offer rewards and punishments. We address them with shouts and murmurs. We stroke them, feed them, and get them to see the world in a way that makes them pliable to our interests, including our interest in their well-being and comfort. However, consciousness is not the same as self-consciousness. It involves sensitivity to information, an ability to respond to stimuli, and, in most cases, a repertoire of needs and desires. But it does not involve the crucial thing that God claimed in addressing Moses, the ability not merely to have mental states, but to attribute them to a center of consciousness and to identify that center of consciousness in the first person, as a person like you. Anthropomorphism does not consist in attributing mental states to animals, or in imagining them to be thinking and feeling as we think and feel. It involves seeing them as persons who identify themselves in the first person and divide the world into I and not I, I and the other, I and you. To think of animals in that way, as in fairy stories, is to suppose that they, like we, have the point of view of the subject, that they, like us, address the world of objects from a place at its edge. And that is to assume something for which we have no grounds. This division between I and not I, which Fichte rightly saw as the distinguishing feature of the rational intellect, lies at the root of the moral life. For with the idea of the self comes that of the other who is another like me. That is what God was pointing out to Moses, and what the Jewish revelation has transmitted down the centuries, namely that the free being who can say I must acknowledge the equal existence of the other. It is why the original commandment, to love God entirely, contains the second, to love your neighbour as yourself. And on these two, Christ said, hang all the law and all the prophets. This takes us back to a point that I dwelt on last time, which is that of the essential relationality of the person. Persons are accountable to others and see themselves as others in the eyes of others. They enter the world of objects as things to be judged and are therefore encumbered by duties and gifted with rights. This point goes radically against the fashionable, but to my mind, nonsensical habit of seeing moral problems in utilitarian terms, as problems that we solve by a kind of economic calculation. In my view, real morality begins where economics stops, at the threshold of the other. Through the ideas of right and duty, we set the ground rules for a negotiated life among strangers. These rules tell us that rights are to be respected and duties obeyed. They confer equality of moral status on all participants to the moral dialogue and impose on us an obligation to justify our conduct in the face of adverse criticism. They bring with them a battery of concepts that entirely transform the worldview and emotions of those who possess them, concepts like justice, desert and punishment, which lie at the heart of our interpersonal responses. Because they must think in that way, in terms of those moral concepts, Self-conscious subjects enter the world of objects already equipped for tragedy. They know that they are judged just as they judge. They know they must account for their actions and that mistakes and defects will be laid at their door. They feel shame, the Schutzgefühl, or protective feeling, as Scheler describes it, which protects them from adverse judgment. They feel guilt, which is the self-punishment that comes from the consciousness of wrong. The original sin is, in my view, not one committed by our distant ancestor in the Garden of Eden. It is, as Schopenhauer put it, der Schuld des Daseins, the crime of existence itself. Or rather, the crime of existence as a person, the crime that no mere animal could ever commit. There is another and yet more puzzling feature of the concept of the person that we need to notice. Persons are not just particulars, they are individuals. We distinguish them and count them as we do the animals. But they also have, or seem to have, a robust identity through time of which they themselves are both the products and the producers. Derek Parfit and others have tried to replace the concept of personal identity with that of the momentary self. But there can be no such thing, I believe, as a momentary self. Being a self is not just a matter of consciousness. It is a matter of taking responsibility for one's acts and passions, of recognizing the long shadows cast into past and future by the eye that shines in the now. I can act in the present only if I take responsibility for the future, and this means that I must recognize my identity as a person through time. Any attempt to dispense with identity through time amounts merely to empty scepticism of the kind expressed by Hume, who was sceptical about personal identity for the reason that he was sceptical about all statements of identity, namely that they involve claims about other times than now. That scepticism is too general to distinguish a special problem about personal identity, and it surprises me that its application by Parfit and others has been received as anything more than a game. Nevertheless, the concept of personal identity creates a striking philosophical problem. Personhood is not a property that I possess, but my way of being me. I am a person only if there is an individual person who I am. In the world of objects, there is the animal, the member of the species Homo sapiens sapiens, which you can single out as you single out any other individual thing. But in my world, the world of the subject, there is what seems to be another thing altogether, whose identity through time is not that of a re-identifiable particular, but that of a responsible individual, whose identity is his own responsibility and, in some sense, his own creation. Somehow, the human animal in the world of objects is identical with the person who I am. But how? Under what sortle, to use David Wiggins's favourite term, and with what criterion of identity? I don't think that any philosopher has given a satisfactory answer to that question. Just as we search the world of objects in vain for the place where freedom enters, so do we search it in vain for the person. Yet persons exist and act in that world, which is the only world that we have. How is this possible? The paradox can be softened through a concept that has played a large part in post-Kantian philosophy, German Romantic philosophy, in other words, and which has been a constant theme of modern art and literature, the concept of self-realization. Though through our actions we do not merely express our states of mind and intentions, we make ourselves present in the world. And in the course of doing this, we also change. What we are for ourselves minutely reflects what we are for others, since it is through our dialogue with others that we understand how we appear in the world. The I you encounter shapes both me and you. And freedom should not be seen as the premise of this encounter, but more as its conclusion. By learning to see myself as you see me, I gain control of my situation as a being in the world. And I learn what I am by imprinting myself on what I am not. Through the life of civil society, through religion, art, and institutions, I shape myself as another in the eyes of others, and so gain consciousness of myself as a subject who acts freely in a world that I share. In a famous passage of the Phenomenology of Spirit, Hegel argues that I-you encounters, which begin in conflict and pass through a stage of subjection, intrinsically tend towards justice, towards the situation in which each party acknowledges the other's right to exist and to be treated equally, and in which relations are founded not on coercion, but consent, in other words, the covenant that God offers to Moses in that original encounter. This is not the place to rehearse Hegel's complex argument. Suffice it to say that, in my view, it establishes that while we are persons by nature, this nature is realized or actualized in what we become. And Hegel shows, to my satisfaction at least, that the process of becoming fully self-identical and self-aware involves coming to see ourselves as others see us, as a you in the world of objects as well as an I in the world of subjects. Through our free actions, we are present in the world as persons. But we can be present only because we are present to others, and that means present objectively in human form. The identity of the person and the human being is therefore something that we achieve by putting the I on display in the visible he. An analogy might help. When painters apply paint to canvas, they create physical objects by purely physical means. Any such object is composed of areas and lines of paint arranged on a surface that we can regard, for the sake of argument, as two-dimensional. When we look at the surface of the painting, we see those areas and lines of paint and also the surface that contains them. But that is not all we see. We also see, for example, a face that looks out at us with smiling eyes. In one sense, the face is a property of the canvas, over and above the blobs of paint. For you can observe the blobs and not see the face, and vice versa. And the face is really there. Someone who does not see it is not seeing correctly. On the other hand, there is a sense in which the face is not an additional property of the canvas, over and above the lines and blobs. For as soon as the lines and blobs are there, so is the face. Nothing more needs to be added in order to generate the face. And if nothing more needs to be added, the face is surely nothing more. Moreover, every process that produces just these blobs of paint arranged in just this way will produce just this face, even if the artist is unaware of the face. Imagine how you would design a machine for producing Mona Lisas, for instance. Now, the person emerges in the human being in something like that way. The person is not something over and above the life and behaviour in which we observe it, but not reducible to them either. Once personhood has emerged, it is possible to relate to a human being in a new way, the way of personal relations. In like manner, we can relate to a picture in ways that we cannot relate to something that we see merely as a distribution of pigments. With this new order of relation comes a new order of understanding, in which reasons and meanings rather than causes are sought in answer to the question why. With persons, we are in dialogue. We call upon them to justify their conduct in our eyes as we must justify our conduct in theirs. Central to this dialogue are concepts of freedom, choice, and accountability. And these concepts have no place in the description of animal behaviour, just as the concept of a human being has no place in the description of the physical makeup of a picture, even though it is a picture in which a human being can be seen. Now, that is only an analogy, however, and we should not think that it solves the deep metaphysical problems that have occupied me in this lecture. I have been discussing the place of freedom in the world of causality, at least last time I was, and the place of the subject in the world of objects. Language seems to fall silent at the threshold of these problems. They lie at the limit and can be solved only by one further step that we cannot actually take, the step beyond the edge of the world. We know that the two problems have a common structure, that they must have a solution. But perhaps it is beyond the power of the human mind to find that solution. A picture is a surface which presents to the normal educated eye an aspect of a thing depicted. Pictures therefore form what philosophers call a functional kind, the kind of thing that presents an aspect to the self-conscious observer. Members of this kind include an enormous variety of objects, canvases, sheets of paper, computer screens, holographs, and so on. In other words, the functional kind subsumes things that belong to many different natural kinds, and some of them not natural things. Likewise, persons are a kind, though not a natural kind. It is true that the behavioural complexity required to exemplify interpersonal responses, to entertain eye thoughts, and to hold oneself and others accountable for changes in the world is something that we witness only in members of a particular natural kind, the kind Homo sapiens sapiens, though some people have doubts about dolphins. But could we not envisage other beings, members of some other species, or of no biological species at all, who exhibit the same complexity of behaviour and are able to engage with us eye to eye? Surely, if so, they belong with us in the order of things, and there is a kind that includes us both. Return for a moment to the evolutionary theory of altruism, which I criticised last time. The soldier ant who marches vainly into the fire under the genetic imperative to defend the anteap is doing something that superficially resembles what the officer does who throws himself on a live grenade in order to protect his troops. The ant dies in the service of its genes. And the evolutionary psychologists would like to say something similar of the officer. But that is not true. He dies in the service of others. His motive is one of self-sacrifice on behalf of his troops, a motive that is available only to a subject who distinguishes self and other, who has the concept of sacrifice, and who can make a gift of his life to another like himself. Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friend, said Christ. The world of the self-conscious being is a world in which there is love as well as attachment, and in which others exist as objects of obligation, places in the web of objects from which light streams in from a transcendental source. Hence it is a world in which just and unjust, virtuous and vicious, beautiful and ugly, right and wrong are all distinguished. Now the example of the self-sacrificing officer shows, to my mind, how the I concept penetrates the human world. The world perceived from this perspective, the first-person perspective, makes demands that no animal can recognize and is arranged according to concepts and kinds that no animal can perceive. We should not be surprised, therefore, that our understanding of the human world cannot be captured by the science of objects. The self-conscious mind paints the world in the colors of subjectivity, and the result is in no way to be dismissed as an illusion, any more than the face in the picture is an illusion. And this brings me to another argument, which I'm going to develop further next time, that might help to soften the paradoxes that I've been placing before you. I argued last time that there is more than one meaning to the question, why? And that the why of science, which looks for causes, should be distinguished from the why of reason, which looks for arguments, and the why of understanding, which looks for meanings. It is not only our inquiries that follow these separate paths, so too do our ways of ordering the world. Science attempts to divide nature at the joints, to group together those things that have a shared structure and a shared causal history. It abounds in concepts of natural kinds and primitive variables, and respects the surface phenomena only so far as is necessary to explain them. Things that we group together for our purposes, such as tables, weapons, and amusements, may have nothing in common from the point of view of natural science, while things which science groups together for the purpose of explanation, such as fungi, silicates, and electromagnetic waves, may have nothing significant in common from the point of view of human uses. The why of explanation, which leads the scientist towards the fundamental structures of the world, is replaced by another question why, turned back from the world towards our interests. We classify things under concepts of functional, moral, and aesthetic kinds. These concepts inform our states of mind, and we perceive the world in terms of them. I look about me and see tables and chairs, ornaments and symbols. I read the world as a sign and an invitation. And the concepts that I use focus my emotions and interests on what is useful and meaningful to me. The fearful, the tragic, the amusing, the delightful. Who is to say that these categories denote anything deep in the things to which they apply, rather than in the experience of the one who applies them? But we distinguish just and unjust, comfortable and uncomfortable, shameful and respectable, just as we distinguish colours and patterns, without inquiring into the underlying motion that throws up these appearances in its wake. Here is an example of what I have in mind, the concept of a melody. Every musical person can distinguish melodies from mere sequences of notes. Melodies have a beginning, a middle, and an end. They begin and they continue until they stop. They have an individual identity and atmosphere. They can be combined and developed according to their inner logic. They can be taken apart, amplified, augmented, and diminished. They are the stuff of music, and unless you can identify them, you will be deaf to what music means. But no science of sound has use for the concept of a melody. As far as acoustics is concerned, melodies are sequences of pitched sounds like any other. Sequences that we hear as melodies are not a different kind of thing from acoustically from sequences that we hear as meaningless successions. And phenomenal features like tension and release, forward motion, gravitational attraction, and sounding through silence don't appear in acoustics. The concept of melody classifies sounds according to a highly sophisticated human interest, and that interest is an interest in surfaces and signs, not in the physical facts that explain them. In other words, there are concepts that direct our mental states, but which can play no role in an explanatory theory, because they divide the world in the wrong kind of way and into the wrong kinds of kind. Concepts like those of ornament, melody, duty, freedom. The concept of the person is such a concept, which does not mean that there are no persons, but only that a scientific theory of persons will classify them with other things, for example with apes or mammals, and will not be a scientific theory of every kind of person. For example, it will not be a theory of corporate persons, of angels, or of God. Hence, the kind to which we belong is defined through a concept that does not feature in the science of human biology. That science sees us as objects rather than subjects, and its descriptions of our responses are not descriptions of what we feel. The study of our kind is the business of the Geisteswissenschaften, the human sciences, which are not sciences at all, but humanities. In other words, exercises in the kind of understanding exhibited when we explain why a play is tragic, a melody charming, or a painting full of grief. The kind concept under which we assemble human beings influences our understanding of their psychological states. These are understood as the states of persons, and not as states that non-personal animals might equally exhibit. And the way we understand them influences the way we experience them. The example of sexual feelings, which I'll return to on Thursday, provides a vivid illustration of what I mean. Sexual relations, the biologist might argue, are to be explained in terms of genetic strategies. There is no difficulty in accounting for phenomena like jealousy, female modesty, male predatoriness, and the well-known typologies of attraction, once we see these things as aspects of genetic investment. My response to this is to say that is fine, so far as it goes. But the explanations given underdetermine the behaviour to be explained. The feature that most needs explaining is precisely the interpersonal intentionality that distinguishes us from our evolutionary neighbours and causes our attachments to reach through the empirical circumstances that give rise to them towards the free subject who is their target. Sexual jealousy in a person is not like its simulacrum in the bonobo, since it involves the thought of betrayal for which another person is answerable. I to you. Monogamy in a person is not like the monogamy of geese or gibbons, in that it involves a lifelong vow of devotion, often conceived in sacramental terms, and in any case between an I and a you. The philosophical truth that our kind is not a biological category is swept out of view by the evolutionary and neuroscientific view of the human condition. It can be conjured back by stories, images, and evocations in something like the way that Milton conjured the truth of our condition from the wonderful raw materials of the Book of Genesis. Milton's allegory, Paradise Lost, is not just a portrait of our kind. It is an invitation to kindness. It shows us what we are and what we must live up to, and it sets a standard for art. Take away religion, however, take away philosophy, take away the higher aims of art, and you deprive ordinary people of the ways in which they can represent their apartness from the rest of nature. Human nature wants something to live up to, becomes something to live down to instead. Biological reductionism, it seems to me, nurtures this living down, which is why people so readily fall for it. It makes cynicism respectable and degeneracy chic. It abolishes our kind, and with it our kindness. But this brings me to the topic of the next lecture, which is that of human love and the human face. Among the most interesting of the concepts that inform and give structure to the human world is that of the face. The science of the human being has no real use for faces. Of course, it recognizes all the components of the face and their disposition in space. It acknowledges that there is such a thing as recognition of the face and its absence in facial agnosia. But it does not acknowledge the thing that makes faces so important to us, namely that they are the outward form and image of the soul, the lamp lit in our world by the subject behind. It is through understanding the face, I shall argue, that we begin to see how it is that subjects make themselves known in the world of objects.
Thank you, Roger, for a wonderful lecture, clear and very deep. And we've got a bit of time for questions from the audience, so over to possible questions.
How or where do you make the distinction between theology and philosophy, especially when you're talking about the beginning study?
Yes, well, it's a very difficult question that you're asking, because we professional philosophers are absolutely confident that we have a subject. but we're also completely, equally confident that nobody else has, unless we authenticate it. The question is whether we do authenticate theology or not. You know, and that I think philosophers would be inclined to say, well, that's a philosophical question, and it's not for theologians to decide. I mean, there is a difficulty with the with theology. Is every example of theology in the world as we know it has grown out of a particular faith, and you can't suppose that the subject of theology is the same in this university as it is in Al-Azhar in Cairo, obviously. But there was a time in the Middle Ages when it would have been the same, when theology was the heart of the university, and it was taught in Muslim countries, it was taught by Jews in Spain in their own way, and also taught in the University of Paris and Padua and so on. And the arguments were shared in those days, because they were those abstract arguments about the God of the philosophers. And in St. Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologiae, which is obviously a very great and comprehensive treatise, there is a genuine subject. But most people would say what is genuine about it is its philosophical breadth. And theology only occupies a very small amount of it. I don't know if that answers the question, but... Are you a theologian?
No.
No, all right, good. So, you. Yes.
I may have misunderstood you, and I was surprised, if I understood correctly, that you suggest that economics begins where morality ends, that suggests that economics exists as some sort of amoral sphere. Maybe I misunderstood you, or let me put it to you as a question if that is.
Well, I actually say it the other way round, that morality begins where economics ends. What I meant by that was simply that the function of morality in the life of the self-conscious being, to my thinking, is to draw the limits to what can be to calculation. To say that, okay, you can calculate this far, you can put so many interests in the balance and balance them against so many others, and that's all very well and good, but there are certain things that you cannot do. And this is where you stop reasoning. And this leads, of course, to dilemmas, as we all know. But if you don't have that sense that there are places beyond which you cannot go, you lose the idea that there is something in the world which has to be considered as a source of value and not just a thing with a price.
But maybe it could be this kind of economics, you could suggest another kind of economic organization.
Yes, I mean, economists always say, yes, sophisticated economists say, don't misunderstand us. All we're doing is dealing with the things that can be calculated. We're not trying to get rid of the idea of intrinsic values. There is a way in which economics can adapt itself to that. But actually, it does create a very difficult problem. Most mathematical economists now will use the idea of preference orderings rather than the idea of utility, a way of calculating the solutions to problems of people's competing desires. Preference orderings don't distinguish between things that people regard as intrinsically valuable and things that they merely want as a means or whatever, or as a source of pleasure. This actually eliminates the things that are really interesting to moral philosophers. And I think this has been one of the great problems that has arisen in current debates over the environment, which have been largely conducted in the wake of the Stern report to the British government, which is entirely econometric in its approach to these things, and therefore eliminates the thing that is really at the back of people's minds, which is the difference between things that we can calculate about and things that we can't calculate about, you know, because they are too precious, like the Earth itself. And this is something which I do want to return to, actually, in the beginning of next week, in talking about the face of the Earth. I don't know if that helps.
It's a question that's been troubling me, listening to you last week in particular, comes into this week, which is the relationship between science and subjectivity. I think it was said last week, forgive me if I don't get this quite straight, I'm not a philosopher myself, was that science treats the human being as object, and you can't, in a way, penetrate subjectivity. Isn't able to speak to subjectivity. But isn't the very process of science, the act of science, doesn't it reveal things about the object that enters into our way in which we think about our subjectivity? How I think about myself as an I, as a person, and how I think about you as a person out there. For instance, since the 18th century, the whole way in which we think about the heart, the role of the heart, in both the body, but also the questions about the soul and so on. So, in that sense, the very practice of science and the study of the object enters into the way in which we think about the subject.
That's a very important point, and I don't deny that it's true that I think I was saying this today, that of course we can't say that we are two things, and the object that is observable in the world of cause and effect, and the subject which reveals itself to itself inwardly, as it were, that these are one and the same thing. But we have what I am saying is that we have a difficulty in reconciling these two perspectives, because they seem to conceptualize the world not just in contrasting ways, but in conflicting ways. And the question is, which should we prefer? And that's this question which I want to go on and talk about later. But some people would say, in response to what you've just said, that while it is true that the growth in our knowledge, scientific knowledge, affects our sense of what we are as subjects, it is also the case that our existence as subjects affects the structure of science. Science, in the end, after all, has to be tested against observations. And that the conditions that govern the possibility of observation are conditions which, of course, stem from my own subjective nature. And that, some people interpret quantum mechanics in this way as showing that the physical reality must, in the end, conform to the stricture that it can be measured by something like me. In other words, that it can be translated into information which is made available to consciousness. And that's a very frightening thought, that actually determines the structure of physical reality. I don't think that's the right interpretation of quantum mechanics, but it's another way of illustrating the potentially paradoxical conflict between the two ways of seeing the world.
Another area where subject and object get very close to being is psychiatry. Someone can be depressed, and then you question whether they're depressed because the brain lacks certain chemicals, or depressed because of life or limbs, and they can't tell the difference.
That is, of course, true, and this again raises the general question of the relation between freedom and determinism. It's true of all our mental states that what's going on in the brain is going to affect them. We don't know how. We don't have usually have the kind of simple connection that we sometimes have in the cases of extreme depression, where we can actually discover a chemical imbalance that's responsible for this. But nevertheless, it is of course true that there is a correlation between what's going on in the brain and what we think. The question is, how do we conceptualize that correlation? That's one of the questions which I've been entertaining without giving a proper answer to it. And it's not, again, it's not that that I would want to deny that we are animals, organized in the way that other animals are. But what emerges from that organization is something that can't be described just as an animal. That's why I would like to take the analogy with the picture seriously. Well, what I would say is let's keep an open mind about them for the purpose of the philosophical argument. At least we have a clear case of self-consciousness in ourselves, and we know that that involves the kind of things that I've been talking about, namely I thoughts and you thoughts, and that we identify ourselves in a way which therefore distinguishes us from the rest of nature. It could be that dolphins have I thoughts and you thoughts. Nobody has ever deciphered their language or even given a proof that it is a language. And there is lots of room for skepticism here. Most of the animals that we have to deal with in our daily lives, dogs and cats and so on, are clearly not like dolphins and don't communicate I to you. Though they communicate with each other in another way. And so I would say, you know, let's not assume too much about them. Doesn't mean we can kick them around.
Would you say that it was language, you talk about language, whether or not it's a language, would you say that language was a necessity for happiness or life in relationships?
Yeah. Well, it's a very interesting question that, I mean, some philosophers would say something like that. That language is the crucial divide between us and the rest of the animal kingdom, and it is the thing which gives us the first person case as one of its byproducts. Though of course there are difficult cases. Deaf and dumb people before the discovery of sign language were nevertheless included in the human community on the understanding that they did have the I-U relationship, and indeed they developed it. And it was, of course, they were hampered in all sorts of ways. And it was interesting, I mean, the discovery of sign language came about because people suddenly discovered something about language, namely that it isn't a matter of making sounds, but a matter of having a transformational grammar. And if we could develop a grammar using just fingers and gestures, then we would liberate these people from their darkness. And indeed, it happened. But I think this is a very deep and difficult question. And people like Chomsky and his followers would say, yes, language is the crucial thing. That's what creates the great ontological divide in the animal kingdom. And he goes further and says that it's not something that can be acquired by degrees. There is nothing between having it and not having it. And therefore there is a real question about how the evolutionary explanation of the acquisition of language should be formulated.
Someone behind first.
Well, certainly you haven't got the question, so maybe it wouldn't matter if I haven't got the answer. I'm saying that I do know this of myself and you, There I do have a criterion, namely the use of language. But there is these dark intermediate cases, like the deaf and dumb person, and maybe the dolphins and the elephants. And about that, I don't know how to decide. I think most difficult concepts bring with them undecidable borderlines. You know, I know that dogs don't have the IU relationship. Well, by this sheer nuisance that my mother-in-law's dog is, his refusal to respond with guilt, anxiety, shame, or self-disgust. You know.
This arises from your wonderful analogy between the face in the painting and the materials which constitute the surface, and then the corresponding analogy between our knowledge, scientific knowledge of the materials, and our aesthetic and perhaps historical and so forth interest in the face that appears. This is very clear and I think very helpful, but and that gives us a kind of contrast between being tuned into the world as a place of persons versus being tuned into it as an object for the natural sciences. But I was wondering, where in all this is there any room for the social sciences? Is this another example of difficult concept with indeterminate borderline cases? I don't think social scientists would be very pleased if they're just a borderline case, but that's another thing that philosophers sometimes say.
Well, yes. The relation between philosophy and the social sciences has not been a uniformly happy one over the years. I did mention the Geisteswissenschaften, and you know the Diltai's original attempt to distinguish the humanities from the natural sciences in terms of the distinction between explanation and understanding, or Verstehen, and all that. And that's a beginning of an attempt to say that the social aspect of human beings is open to another kind of investigation than the biological aspect of human beings. But, of course, things have changed a lot recently because the evolutionary psychologists have put a spanner in the works. People like John Tooby and later Cosmides will say, look, the social sciences have been proceeding in the wrong way, as though culture were an independent variable. They should have been looking at what we have in common and looking at the adaptations that our species has acquired and seeing how we can explain our behaviour without going this great detour through culture, simply in terms of the adaptations that were necessary to solve the evolutionary problems of the Pleistocene age. And so there's all this has been thrown into disarray, I think, by them, or by that kind of person. I would say, sort of step back and keep out of it and say, look, philosophy has a lot to say about this, but it's not going to determine just which of these many competitors is going to be the real natural science of man.
Answers to the question about persistent vegetative state and your answer about the IU relationship in terms of dogs, that in a sense those are empty questions because you chose not to give an answer to both of those questions. That leads me to imply, you might not intend to say this leads me to imply that you think that the question of person is the person who is empty in relationship to those states. If that is the case, why should the question matter in relation to us?
that's a strong point. I don't want to say that the question is empty. I think there are cases where it's undecidable. I don't think it is undecidable in the case of the dog. As I say, I think that there's a whole philosophical literature on what is sometimes called marginal humans, where some aspect of the human condition is not manifest in what is nevertheless clearly a human body, and whether we should therefore withdraw some of the privileges that we offer to humans in cases like this. Obviously, idiots, people in terminal comas and so on, raise these questions. And I would say it may be that these are questions that don't have an answer. Simply because the concepts are not designed in that way. They're not designed as mathematical concepts are designed to have clear, to have clear borderlines. That doesn't mean that we can't say, for instance, of dogs and cats, that they are radically different from us in the respects that I've been discussing. Because I think we can say that in that particular case. And everybody admits that there are some cases where we're dealing with animals that are clearly different from us in their mental capacities. Insects, for instance. There's a question whether insects feel pain and all that, but there's no question whether they actually have ambitions, or whether they fall in love, etc. I don't know. Given my position, which is that persons are not a natural kind, there is nothing metaphysical to prevent it. Depends just how sophisticated it is. If it's really as sophisticated as me, I mean, how do you know I'm not this thing? You haven't looked inside. So I think that one would have to keep an open mind. Shut them up. Fantastic.
Well, Roger, I thank you very much for this generous engagement in discussion, as well as a splendid, extremely stimulating lecture. And join me in thanking you.